Well, exactly on time. Let's get started. I don't get a chance to say that very often. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And I want to thank you for showing up here on the second day of the work year, the second day after Labor Day. And I want to welcome you on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, to this program that'll, we hope, help you better understand how employers and consumers are being affected now and are going to be affected in the future by the new health reform law. Now, for those under 65, employers are the most important source of health coverage. About 160 million of us get coverage through our or our family member's employer. And the percentage of workers in firms offering coverage actually rose in 2010 from 91% last year to 93%, according to the Kaiser HRET annual survey that was just out last week. A summary of that survey's findings in your kits. You'll also see there that the continued sharp difference between larger employers and smaller ones persisted in the likelihood that their workers are going to be offered coverage. 99% of the biggest firms offer it. Only 59% of the smallest ones do. And you're going to hear today from speakers knowledgeable about the effect of the new law on both larger and small businesses. At the same time, this law holds out the prospect of substantial change for patients or consumers of coverage and care. There are going to be sweeping changes in the structure of insurance markets and requirements to have coverage, and in the short run, a bunch of new consumer protection machinery, expanded counseling available through most states, mandated coverage of preventive services, and a bunch of other features of this legislation. To coin a phrase, there are a lot of moving parts in this new law, and we're pleased to be able to help you look at this schematic diagram a bit more closely today. Our partner in sponsoring this briefing is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the nation's largest philanthropy that's devoted exclusively to health and health care. This is a part of a series on health reform implementation that the two organizations have collaborated on, and we expect that this is not the end of the series, since it may be implemented over a period longer than September 8, 2010. We're very pleased to have with us Brian Quinn, who is the senior program officer in RWJ Foundation's Research and Evaluation Unit. Brian, we're happy to have you with us, and maybe you could offer some comments for us.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you to everyone on the Alliance team for putting together such a nice program this afternoon. It certainly couldn't be any timelier. At the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we're committed to helping all Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. We look at the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act as having a real potential to impact these goals over the long term. And yet, while the passage of the Affordable Care Act is an important first step towards achieving the goals of the foundation, it was really only the beginning. And as much as the legislative process was difficult, the implementation process will be just as challenging. When we think about a lot of the changes that are going to go into effect as a result of the law over the coming years and the major decisions that need to be made during the implementation process, perhaps some of the biggest are in the way that insurance is bought and sold, whether it's in the large group market, the small group market, or the individual market. So I'm really pleased today that we're going to be looking at some of the key issues facing employers as they grapple with reform, and I'm also pleased that we're going to explore the challenges and opportunities facing consumers as they operate in a new marketplace. The Foundation cares deeply about these issues. We see our role as sharing the best knowledge and information that come from our grantees and our partners in the field, and think it's important to share these with different healthcare leaders and decision makers like yourselves. And to that end, we're supporting a number of different activities around implementation in the next couple of years. We're supporting quick turnaround research and analysis by our grantees at the Urban Institute to help policymakers and key stakeholders better understand the impact and implications of reform. Our health reform GPS project at George Washington is analyzing the legislation and highlighting key questions that will need to be addressed during the implementation process. We have a project at the National Academy of Social Insurance to develop model legislation that states can use as they design exchanges and plan regulations to their insurance markets. And for the last several years, we've supported the Consumer Voices for Coverage program, which is working to support networks of state-level consumer advocates to ensure that the consumer voice is included in policy discussions around healthcare reform. And finally, we're supporting the work of organizations like the Alliance for Health Reform that are connecting policymakers here in Washington with some of the leaders and experts on these issues. So I'm looking forward to the discussion today. Thank you for joining us. And, Ed, thank you to your team for putting it together.
Very good. Thanks, Brian. Excuse me. Just a couple of logistical notes before we go forward. Obviously, you have some background material in your packets. There's more material online at the Alliance website at allhealth.org. You'll also find some biographical information on all our panel members that'll go beyond the very modest introductions they'll get from me. The webcast and podcast of this briefing will be available sometime tomorrow at the website kff.org, which is a service of the Kaiser Family Foundation. In a few days, you'll also be able to see a transcript on our website, allhealth.org. There are green question cards you can use at the appropriate time, microphones that you can use to ask questions once we get to that part of the program. And if you would, remember to fill out that blue evaluation form that will help us to inform and improve these programs as we go along. Now, we have a very knowledgeable panel with a broad range of experience. Brief presentations from them, then we're going to save the bulk of the time, as we usually do, to respond to your questions. And we're going to start today with Steve Wojcik, the Vice President of Public Policy for the National Business Group on Health. Those of you who are not familiar with the business group, it's a nonprofit membership organization of large employers. In fact, their members provide coverage to more than 50 million Americans, workers, retirees, and their families. Steve has more than a generation of experience in health policy and in both his current position and in some large health plans, in academic and in nonprofit settings as well. So we're very pleased to have Steve with us today to start the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed, and thanks for inviting me. And I look forward to questions at the end. As you can imagine, there are a lot of issues that large employers are grappling with, and I'm only going to touch on a very few, but I'm happy to take any questions that you might have on other areas or further elaboration of what I touch upon. So I'm going to focus on the practical issues that our large employer members, largely Fortune 500 private employers, private sector employers, have had and have presented us with and are seeking answers either through us or through the regulations that help to clarify the legislation. I want to point out that as large employers, any employer of any size usually self-funds or self-insures. So technically, they're not buying insurance from an insurer. I know a lot of you know that, but just for the benefit of those that don't. So think of it as the employer's money, the capital of the company, is at risk. They have to set aside a certain amount in anticipation of healthcare claims by their employees and dependents and retirees, because large employers are still, many of them are still offering retiree coverage. So that's the first point. So they're looking at this from that point of view. And then also, they're very active in designing their plans, changing the benefits, changing the pharmacy benefit, for example, adding a wellness program or a disease management program, adopting a centers of excellence, for example, the Lowe's home improvement store just this year adopted cardiovascular centers of excellence where complex cardiovascular cases among their employees can, at their choosing, voluntarily go to the Cleveland Clinic with no cost to them. And that's an example of an innovation that an employer is offering, and that's kind of how they get into the details. They don't just accept the off-the-shelf products that an Aetna, Humana, or Blue Cross offers. They may contract with them as administrators of their plan, so they process all the claims and they use the provider network that the health insurer has negotiated or created with through negotiations with the hospitals and physicians. So I just want to start out by saying that. So, and that'll be important as we go through some of the provisions that impact that. Employer plans are operating in the face of a lot of uncertainty, as you can imagine, and I think it's helpful to go through the cycle of plan design changes. So every year, beginning in January, usually a large employer plan, the benefits people, the finance department, the human resources people, and the CEO and the executives ultimately will sign off on to changes. So they consider changes beginning in the spring of the year. This year, because of the healthcare legislation and all the uncertainty, a lot of large employers froze their plan changes. The plan changes are designed to maintain the affordability of the benefit. Again, remember the employer, a lot of the funding is through the employer, and they're managing the risk of the healthcare for their employees. There is an employee portion, which the news out today says that the employee portion is going up and is likely to go up. But they also use it as a tool to maintain the attractiveness of their benefits. And most plans, most large employers benchmark with other employers in their industry. For example, I mentioned Lowe's. They're benchmarking with Home Depot and other similar retailers because they want to make sure that their benefits are competitive and they're attracting and retaining the right people, that they're not losing them because of the benefits to Home Depot, for example. And they also want to improve the health and maintain the productivity or improve the productivity of their employees, and so they do that through their benefits. And they consider lots of changes based on cost, quality, financial considerations of the company, the labor market, the general economic conditions. So all of that factors in. A lot of that was on hold. They do feel that, and we'll see in a later slide on the decision to become a grandfathered plan versus a non-grandfathered plan was factored into that decision to put plan changes on hold. Most employers, not surprisingly, feel that the plan administration costs will go up. We did a survey of our members, and about 60%, 59% to be exact, thought the healthcare legislation was going to raise their plan administration costs. Because remember, they're actively involved in administering the plan. They're not just letting the health insurers provide the benefits, and they're making all these, looking at all these changes, monitoring the utilization, and trying to improve the benefit for future years. They also expect the overall cost trends to continue in healthcare because of the fact that the underlying delivery system changes that are needed. There are some seeds of that in Medicare. They need to be adopted widespread throughout Medicare and throughout the private healthcare system as well. And we're hoping that the Medicare quality and payment and delivery system initiatives improve Medicare, and that has a spillover effect positively on the private plans. The Towers-Watson survey that was in your packet also says that found that 90% of employers expected their healthcare costs to grow as a result of increase as a result of the legislation. And then just another survey, just quickly, Mercer, another health benefits consulting firm like Towers Watson, found basically 66% of employers feel that their costs are going to go up. And then, again, underlying the uncertainty, 30% are not certain. So that's pretty much close to 100%. They're either feeling that their costs are going to go up or that they don't know and they really need more information. So the things that the plans have been dealing with for 2011, and remember, the plan cycle is you make the plan changes, you finalize them by the end of spring, and then you do all the employee communications and the benefit books and all the electronic communications. You set that up, and it's usually finalized by August, and then you have all along you have the senior executives either making changes or buying into the changes that are proposed. And then it's pretty much at this point ready for rollout. But as you can see, we've had they've had a delay, so now they're having to play catch up with the requirements that are due beginning January 1st, because most plans operate on a calendar year. So the dependent coverage to age 26, the annual and lifetime, mainly the annual dollar limits on overall benefits are an issue for the plans. The health account changes are minor, but just to give you some idea of the types of things that they're considering, covering dependents to age 26, they don't have any pricing information for that because most plans covered dependents up to age 19, or if you're a student, up to age 24. So, and there are some restrictions in the law, as you probably know, about how you can price for that. So some of the things that employers are considering, and again, they don't have a lot of information to go on, so they may do adjustments in future years, they're considering a surcharge for any kind of dependent coverage, whether it's spousal or family coverage, to help account for the increased costs that are expected for the adult dependent coverage. Another thing that plans are doing, rather than having a price for family coverage, they're breaking it down into the number of dependents. So they'll have employee coverage is this price. Usually that's heavily subsidized by the employer, and the employee pays a little. But for dependent coverage, employees in many at many companies pay more. But now what they're doing is saying one dependent is this price, two dependents this price, three dependents this price, et cetera. So obviously there's a redistributive effect, so that the larger your family is or the larger dependents you have, you're probably going to be paying more with the new situation than people who have fewer dependents. So that's one of the impacts. On the annual limits, the real issue is coming up in the future when there can be no annual limits on what the government has laid out in vague categories as minimum essential benefits. And so many plans are concerned because they may have some extra benefits. Like one plan I know offers home health care, but they have a dollar limit on it. And so they're worried about whether that's going to be possible or not, or whether they should just eliminate that benefit altogether. So that's a quick example. I know I need to move on fairly quickly. Deciding whether to relinquish grandfather plan status in 2011 or down the road, as I mentioned, plans are used to considering all kinds of changes, and it's a routine thing that happens annually. Now, for the first time, there are restrictions, and you have to make a decision as a plan whether you want to continue as a grandfathered plan and be exempt from the HHS quality and financial reporting requirements, the government external review process, and the internal appeals process, which go above and beyond what ERISA and the Department of Labor currently require. So those are some issues, and they had to make those decisions quickly. We don't have all the information about what the implications are for being a non-grandfathered plan, except that a lot of the requirements will be dictated by HHS, which is a new entity for most employer plans to deal with. The preventive services requirements, the main issues there, most employer plans have very generous preventive services at little or no cost to the employee. But there are some issues about, some worries about whether the preventative services benefits in the future are going to be more subject to the political process or provider pressure rather than the clinical and medical evidence that the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force had previously based decisions on. I haven't been advancing the slides. So looking ahead now, because at this point plans normally would have finalized things for 2011, they're making the last minute changes due to the legislation. Now they're looking ahead. There are some issues because beginning for the tax year of 2011, employer plans have to report on the W-2 forms the value of the employer-sponsored benefits. And there are some issues. Most of it's based on how you calculate the current COBRA premiums minus the administrative costs for that. But there are some issues where an employer provides a benefit that's more global and not so individual, like the worksite health clinics. Some employers have pharmacies through the work. Wellness programs, all of those things, we're waiting for the regulations that are coming out to see how and if we have to include those in the value of the health coverage that the employer is getting. lots of other issues. I'm not going to get bogged down on it. Just quickly looking into the future, the Cadillac tax, most plans are going to do whatever they can to avoid that tax because it doesn't help the employee or the employer to pay 40% above the threshold as a tax. And they know it's going to be passed on, even though technically it's the administrator or the insurer that pays that tax. It's going to be passed on to the employer and the employee. The employee voucher piece, we tried hard to find the part-time employee exemption for that. That apparently might have been an unintended consequence of the employee voucher, where an employee who makes a certain amount of income or lower can cash out, even if they never accepted or took up the employer's offer before. That's a potentially troublesome issue for employers who are doing the right thing and offering part-time coverage to then be penalized, where under the free rider assessment, if they just drop the coverage altogether, there's no penalty. So hopefully that'll be resolved before 2014, because that's a big issue for employers. And I think I'm going to stop there now. But feel free to ask me any questions on that. I didn't even cover the retiree health issue, which I would say that's the area where there's a lot of uncertainty created by the legislation about the future retiree health benefit strategy for most employers.
Far bigger than a $5 billion question, right?
Yes, and maybe the subject of a panel all of its own.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve. Next, we're going to welcome back to the Alliance podium Janet Troutwine, who's both a health economist and the CEO of the National Association of Health Underwriters. NAHU's members are about 100,000 health benefits professionals who find appropriate health plan choices for businesses and individuals around the country. Janet has testified before Congress on health insurance issues more times than you can count, and she's been on a few Alliance programs as well. We're very happy to have you back. Janet?
Well, thank you very much. Well, it's hard in a short period of time to talk about all of the things that impact business relative to the health reform legislation. I'm going to focus my remarks today primarily on how the law impacts small business and just focus in on a few of the things that impact small businesses. And I would just start off by saying, and do I have the clicker? I would just start off by saying that I think the way the law was written, there's definitely an expectation that businesses would continue to offer coverage to their employees. And I think we need to be certain that that's what actually happens over the course of time, because there are some things in the legislation that I think have resulted in some different decisions by some employers on a preliminary basis. And so we're hoping over the next few years to make sure that people are educated appropriately on what the best way is to use the various provisions of the legislation. And one of them is something that happened very quickly, and Congress very wisely included a small business tax credit to help small employers pay for coverage. They made it effective immediately and retroactive back to January 1st, so that at the end of this year, small employers will be able, certain small employers, if they meet the requirements, will be able to collect a credit. And there, I have the provisions on the screen there as to which small employers are eligible. It is restricted based on the size of the employer, so it's 25 employees or less. And then it's on a sliding scale. The lower your average wages are, the higher credits you get, and so forth. And nonprofits are eligible, so it doesn't have to be just those who owe taxes. Nonprofits are eligible as well. And so many small businesses will benefit from this. The credit isn't huge, and some small employers, when they do the calculation, have complained a little bit about the fact that the credit is small and that some people won't be eligible. And so I don't think there was ever an intention that everyone would benefit from it, but some will, and it's good that there will be some benefit and a really good starting off incentive for small employers to stay in the game. I do think this is real important. Another thing that's very, very important to small employers, very, very impacted by the cost of coverage. And so many of them were concerned about whether or not they would be able to keep the coverage that they had. And so that brings up the whole thing that Steve mentioned of grandfathering status. And in order for, we do have regulations on this, and there's been a comment period, but the bottom line is that in order for a small employer or any employer or an individual to keep the coverage they have, they can't make too many changes. And the changes that they can make are pretty prescriptive, and it's not going to allow you to make too many changes. Now, some of the small employers have complained to our members, who their clients, that they really would prefer not to have had some of the things that the government thought was good for them. You know, they have liked the additional costs that came to their grandfathered plan, for example, moving the lifetime limit up to unlimited or covering dependents up to age 26. But I think many of them are becoming accustomed to it now. And one thing that's unique about the smaller employer is that they may not have the kind of options that Steve was describing in really getting down to the fine detail of designing their own plans. They typically purchase fully insured plans where the design is prescribed by the insurance company. Many insurance companies are adopting most of the provisions of the legislation, whether the group wants them or not. And so there is a cost to that, and we estimate the additional cost in 2011 just for adding the things that everyone has to have at about 4 to 5% increase in costs, not counting any other increases that may be happening. So some are worried about that. And a small employer, again, works on a very narrow margin. There is no room for any extras. And so some of them are worried about this, and they're worried about not being able to make changes if they can't afford it. And some are saying, well, if I can't have what I want, then in 2014, when coverage is guaranteed issue, I'm just not going to do it anymore, and I'll let my employees go. And they'll all be, many of them will be subsidized through the exchange. I think that's, we hope that they're not going to do that, and we're going to keep working to help them find ways to keep the coverage that they can elect affordable, because certainly it increases the cost of health reform if we have a lot of people electing subsidies that we didn't plan on electing them. So I mentioned 2014. These are definitely some things that impact small employers. Everyone's required to carry coverage. All individuals are required to carry coverage. There are tax penalties, small ones, for noncompliance. There are some exceptions for people at lower income levels and who are experiencing hardship. Also in 2014, there are some new annual taxes on private health insurance premiums, and I would point out that this does disproportionately affect small business, since this only applies to insured plans as opposed to self-insured plans. So the small employer and the individuals are the ones that get hit with the new annual taxes. And then businesses with more than 50 full-time employees will have fines potential if they don't offer qualifying coverage and one of their employees elects coverage to the exchange and gets a subsidy for it. Now, given that you can get a subsidy up to almost $80,000 of annual income, a lot of people theoretically could be eligible for this. So employers are nervous about this one. Some are considering paying the fines instead of continuing coverage, and we are going to be encouraging them to look differently at that decision, but we have heard that a number of times, so I should mention it to you. In 2014, because everyone has to have coverage, all coverage is guaranteed issue, so there are no health questions. All coverage is, if you apply for it, you get it. It's guaranteed renewable. There's no more pre-existing conditions for anybody. There are some significant rate restrictions on how much your rate can be in individuals and small groups. And for the vast majority of small businesses, not counting the ones that are kind of on the East Coast over here where we are, most businesses across the country will face rate increases because of the new rating requirements. And so they're worried about that as well. And then the whole idea of what a small group is redefined in 2014 to go up to 100 employees, where today it's 50. Also in 2014, a new market for health insurance is created in each state, and many small employers as well as individuals may choose to buy coverage there, or they may choose to continue to buy coverage outside the exchange. But each state is required to have this exchange. And a lot of people, when they think of an exchange, they think of the Massachusetts connector. And I think that will be one option for the way states set it up. But National Association of Insurance Commissioners is definitely working on a number of different models that states might want to elect from. We also have an operational exchange in Utah, which is very different than Massachusetts, but works very well for the citizens there. So each state will have some choices about how they set it up. Within each exchange will actually be two different exchanges, one for individuals, which, by the way, could include self-employed people, and then another one for called a shop exchange, which would be intended to be for small businesses to purchase coverage there. And so we'll have to see how much that affects the availability of coverage. It really depends on how a state sets it up. One thing I need to mention in conjunction, not only with the exchanges, but coverage outside, is that in 2014, not only do we have all these other things happening that I've described, but what coverage looks like or what it's required to look like in order to meet that requirement to be minimum level coverage for people to have in order to meet the individual purchase requirement, that will be defined. And there will be levels of coverage. I'm not talking about standardized plans, but various levels for people to select from in order to, and that will be approved for, to be qualified plans. And I don't have time to go into too much detail on those, but one of the things that small employers have said they're concerned about, many of them have health reimbursement arrangements or health savings accounts with deductibles that are higher than the minimum deductibles of $2,000 and $4,000 that are listed in the statute. And so some of the small employers have said, you know, we don't know if we can afford deductibles that low. And they're the ones that many times that we see that are talking about maybe just not offering coverage anymore. So we hope we have some time to work on that a little bit between now and 2014 so that we have employers staying in the game and not leaving the market. I mentioned subsidies a few minutes ago. Subsidies will be available primarily for people who don't have employer-sponsored coverage, but I mention it here because there are provisions for people to opt out of their employer-sponsored coverage to instead get coverage through the exchange if that coverage is not affordable for them. And so if you have specific questions about that, I encourage you to ask them during the question and answer period. And then the last thing that Steve mentioned, in 2018, we have this excise tax on plans that cost above a certain level of amount. And it's pretty controversial. A lot of people don't like it. And as Steve said, a lot of employers are also going to try to figure out how to keep their premiums below the minimum level so that they're not subject to that. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Janet. There we go. And now we're going to turn to Terry Gardner for our next presentation. Terry's the National Policy Director for the Small Business Majority. Now, that's the name of the group, not a membership claim. It's, in fact, a relatively new organization that played a very active role in the recent reform debate. Terry himself is a former Alaska state legislator. He's a small business owner himself for many years. Just ask him about Alaskan seafood. I'm sure he'll have the answers for you. Thanks for coming back from your Alaska vacation to be part of our panel, Terry.
Thank you. And my first advice, of course, is eat a lot of Alaska seafood if you want to stay healthy. And the other question people often ask me is whether I've seen Russia, and the answer is no. And my trip recently was right on the Bering Sea, very close to Russia. I did see some Russian Orthodox churches, from their stay in Alaska. As Ed mentioned at the beginning, we're still going to have an employer-based system, and the numbers here are from the final CBO report, where they summarized, where we're going to end up after the exchange is set up and reform is fully implemented. And you can see that they're predicting that 159 million people are still going to be covered through employers, and then additionally, of course, you've got people going through the exchanges, which is the biggest change, along with Medicaid. And to us, the success of healthcare reform is really dependent on whether this actually happens, that the employer-based system continues to work and is retained and is strengthened. There is a very interesting report out by RAND where they did a simulation of what are employers and individuals going to do when the exchange and all these subsidies and different rules take effect. And they actually concluded that there would be 13 million new people covered by employer coverage, which would be an increase of 12%. And they pointed out that in their scenario, most of that increase would come from small employers. As several people have commented, we hope that is how it pans out. And that is similar. They account for that based on the combined effect of the individual mandate and the exchange. And they cite Massachusetts in the increase in coverage and the increase of employer-sponsored coverage as examples and consistent with their forecast. And I think it's important to think about when we look at the individual exchange and the shop exchange and health reform with small employers, what are we really talking about? There's 22 million self-employed. They're out there working and servicing all of us, all the food you eat, 2 million family farmers. All my commercial fishermen in Alaska and other coastal states are all self-employed business owners. And you have realtors and much of your housing and contractors. So it's a big population, and 28% of these folks do not have coverage today. So the individual exchange and their eligibility for individual subsidies will be very important. The main thing with small employers is to understand is there's a lot of them. And this really has a lot of impacts when you think about setting up 51 exchanges out there. They're going to have to deal with all of these millions of employers that will now qualify up to 100. And they have 43 million people. So right between those two buckets, 22 million self-employed and 43 million employees for small employers under 100, you've got a lot of people way beyond the CBO projection of 24 million that potentially could be going through the exchange. Connecticut exchange, their average employee, their average size of firm that they cover, some 5,400 firms, is 8 employees. And I think that's the reality of the small business population. It's a very flat pyramid with huge amounts of firms at the bottom. And you can see that 80% of them are under 10 employees. So when we think about setting up exchanges, that's what we're talking about. We worked with Families USA on a projection from the Lewin Group, with their economic model, trying to understand better, and we have some state-by-state breakouts about the eligibility for the credit. And most importantly here, as this points out, 1.2 million companies would be eligible for the full credit. That means they have under 10 employees and under 25,000 average wage. So while the other firms in between are going to get a partial credit, as pointed out, that may not be that big for 1.2 million companies. This is significant. And CBO projected this approximately $4 billion average is going to flow into that credit. So regardless of how many companies and their assessment of size, it is $4 billion flowing in that direction. And cite here the example that I think tells us a lot about small business and the credit. One insurer went out and actively marketed the availability of the credit, explained it to small businesses, and they got a lot of new companies who never had coverage to provide coverage because of the credit. And I think it tells us that the small businesses really, the millions of them out there, don't know a lot about health reform. They don't know how it works. They don't know how they're accessed. That there has to be a lot of education and outreach. There's a lot of important things as we look at the exchange out there. But the small employer is going to have multiple choices. They can buy insurance through the exchange, they can buy insurance through the outside, in the outside market, or they can maintain their grandfathered plan, or if they're under 50, there's no reason, you know, they have their choice without penalty to offer or not offer. They only have to consider their competitive position. Small businesses are hoping for a lot of good things to flow from the establishment of exchanges for small businesses. The number one, of course, is the affordability. And I list here several factors that many experts have pointed to that could drive more affordable coverage. There's also the issue of premium volatility from a small business point of view that they would like to see more stability. It's one thing to see all these statistics, but as an individual business, I can tell you the bottom, lots of times you're just slammed with big increases annually because you had a small change in your workforce and other factors. So that's an important gain small businesses hope to get from the exchange. The other is more of a competitive factor. The reason employers offer health insurance is to recruit and retain qualified employees that they need to have a successful business, whether they're large, medium, or small. Small employers really cannot offer multiple plans the way the system works today. Through the exchange, they will be able to tell their employees, just like FEHBP here for federal employees, that, okay, you're working for one employer, but you have multiple choices. This would be an advantage. The Connecticut Exchange does this. They have multiple plans, four insurers, and the insurers each offer 12 plans, and that goes a long ways towards helping small employers. The other thing that we're trying to get across to people in the states working on these exchanges is it's really important to keep the exchange simple and really working on behalf of small employers. And I list here many features of what we call the single point of entry. It's not going to work if there's a big administrative burden on small businesses. It's got to be simple for them to use because, again, if you have an average of 8 employees, the person running the company is the CEO, the vice president of marketing, the HR manager. She is doing everything. So, you know, it's got to be simple. Lastly, look to the continued implementation effort. There is a huge need as we meet with small businesses out there. They're trying to figure this out. There was multiple bills. There's a lot of voices out there claiming this or that about what the law says, and there's a lot of confusion and lack of education. So they first have to figure out what it is, what are all their options, how is this exchange going to work. And a lot of them, in our surveys, half of them don't belong to any business organization. So you just can't count on the Chamber of Commerce or Small Business Majority or any one organization. And a lot of times, even if they do belong to a business organization, it's a trade group that you probably never heard of, not the typical business organizations. And I think business owners typically rely on their channels of who they're used to dealing with, and this is why it's real important to look at the question of brokers, and there's a lot of debate on this. These are a list of some of the major issues that we see on the exchange from a small business point of view, and how these are resolved will affect how well the exchange works from a small employer point of view. And I think the one overall message we're trying to get out is there is a lot of attention to the individual and the individual exchange and eligibility and all this. And to a great extent, places like Massachusetts are more an example of an individual exchange. It's really not, there are not thousands, you know, there's 135,000 small businesses under 50 in Massachusetts, but only a small fraction of them are actually in the exchange today. So there has to be a lot of attention given to creating the so-called shop exchanges for small businesses to get them to work right. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Terry. Finally, we're going to hear from Steve Finan. Steve's a health economist. He's director of policy for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network, ACS-CAN, as they call it. And that is the advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. Steve handles health policy for both organizations. Before joining the Action Network, he was a senior economist at the Treasury Department, where he was, I can tell you, one of the very few people in town who understood the TRADE Act health insurance tax credit, not an unapplicable set of skills to the current situation. He's also served stints at OMB, at HHS, and here on the Hill, and we're pleased to have you as part of the panel. Steve?
Oh, okay. Thank you, Ed, and good afternoon. I have the unenviable task of presenting the consumer view, and it's unenviable because all of you are consumers. So theoretically, I guess I'm speaking for behalf of all of you. Let me start by making a few comments about where we've been. And the fact is the healthcare system, the health insurance system that's essentially been in existence for 60 or 70 years, has been extraordinarily unfriendly. For the most part, insurance was based on risk selection and risk segmentation. The way the market has been structured, the way competition has worked, it has always been or largely been about risk selection. That, in turn, was built on the fact that there's consumer ignorance. On a scale of 1 to 10, about consumer knowledge in the health, I think we're close to zero. If you think about what you do as consumers in any other market, whether it's common everyday items like clothing or food or higher end products like a new home or a car or electronics, you can get enormous amount of information if you want it. But on health insurance, can you get it? Probably not. It's very difficult. It's often incomprehensible or inaccessible. And to complement that is the fact that the system is really one-dimensional. It's been based largely on price. Consumers ask, how much does it cost? And they make the decision on that. Do they know anything about quality? Do they know anything about coverage? Probably not. It's just been, in terms of how you would review this and rate it from the consumer, it has been truly awful. What does the ACA do? And in fact, it does a tremendous amount about moving the system towards an orientation of being consumer friendly and constructing a consumer market. The overall goals, there were four of them really, if you think about it from a consumer perspective, is making sure that insurance was available, making sure it was affordable. For the first time we have really significant subsidies are now available to help middle and lower income families to meet the cost of health insurance. Adequacy, Janet mentioned the essential benefit package, and I want to come back to that in a moment, but for the first time, we're going to start to try to define what adequate coverage should really be. And last, but certainly not least, is the administrative simplicity. As I said, the current system is extraordinarily opaque. And for the first time, we're going to make some changes, and very important changes, that will begin to make the system much more accessible and friendly to the consumer. So what are the tools that the ACA puts in place? Well, let's start with the insurance reforms. And these are just a few. There are actually many. But the point is here that there are fundamental changes to the insurance reform. No more use of health status is extraordinarily important. As someone who represents the patient community, the cancer patients, eliminating health status as a factor in health insurance is just huge. I mean, it's bizarre to think of health insurance, which is to provide financial security in case of a catastrophic event and ensure access to health when it's most needed, would somehow discriminate against the very people who most need it, which are those with conditions like cancer and heart disease, chronic disease or chronic conditions where there's a truly ongoing need for health care. The no more rescissions. It's one of the dirty little secrets of the system. It appears to have been growing, but again, it's eliminated. The no annual or lifetime limits. Again, the purpose of insurance, any insurance, is to protect people against financial loss. And for the first time, we're actually taking steps to make sure that that piece of the puzzle is in place for insurance. The guaranteed availability, the establishing medical loss ratios. Again, these are all steps. Initial steps, very important steps, towards reforming the health insurance system and making it one that's much more compatible and consumer-friendly. Then there are the institutional reforms, which are actually more fundamental and probably more and certainly critical. The essential benefits package is probably, from our perspective, the patient perspective, probably the single most important item in the ACA. Because for the first time ever, the federal government is going to define what we mean by essential. That means every consumer, every potential patient is going to be affected, but it's even much more than that, because every provider is going to be affected, every healthcare business, every healthcare investor is potentially affected. We're finally, right now, much of the attention in town is being on health exchanges for the right reasons because of the timetable and so forth and the fact that states have so much involvement. But I think once HHS steps up and puts out a proposal on the essential benefits package, we will see an extraordinary, very extraordinary debate, and one that is actually necessary but certainly going to be complicated and significant. The ratings of plans, the fact is, again, you can go to consumer reports for most consumer products and get a nice rating. There are other ways of beginning using information others have assembled to begin to help you rate what a product is. But that doesn't exist today for health insurance. Even the bronze, silver, gold, which is and platinum system, which is very simplistic in a lot of ways, is at least a very critical first step towards helping consumers begin to understand what it is they're actually purchasing. The internet portal, the assembling the healthcare.gov, I hope you've all gone to that at this point. It's a very consumer-friendly website. It looks like something like Amazon.com or Overstock.com, something like that that is a system that's very friendly. But this is about health insurance. It's really quite amazing to think that you can now get a consumer-friendly website. And it's very basic at this point, but although it has a lot of information, but the potential growing out in terms of providing information to consumers is just enormous. And I guess it's October 1st when they're going to start putting premium information and a lot more plan-specific information, which is basically unavailable today in virtually every state. Patient navigators, just a clear recognition that there have to be people to help consumers navigate through their way through the system. How that gets defined will be important, and it's not clear at this point, but again, it's another piece of the puzzle that consumers need. And again, I mentioned the standardized forms, processes, the integration of Medicaid with exchanges is again, will be perhaps difficult, but very, very important to helping that population get and maintain access to care over a continued period of time. And then last but not least is we should talk about the delivery system reforms. What we have today is still for the most part, certainly Medicare, but in many other parts of the system too, is a fee-for-service, which is rewarding providers based on volume, not necessarily the outcome of the care. Would you want to buy a car by going to AutoZone and getting the 25,000 parts and putting it together yourself? I don't think so. I think we all want to go to the showroom and see the car and see the final product and touch it, feel it, and get the reviews and ratings of it from others who are more professional than we are as general consumers. That's the way we need to go. and it's going to be very difficult. There are parts of the healthcare system, and there's certain kinds of health conditions today where you can get good, very good information about treatment. But for the most part, we have a long ways to go. Certainly in the case of cancer, we've made very little progress. But there is precedent for measuring outcomes and knowing what good healthcare is for something like cancer and a lot of other chronic conditions. And if we want to really improve the health of this country, as well as get costs under control, we've got to move towards a system where patients know what good outcomes can be expected and where providers are rewarded and incentivized to move in that direction. There's the coverage expansion of prevention. From our perspective, the cancer perspective, that's very, very important. But for a lot of conditions, it is. We talk about it a lot in the society, but if you look at the healthcare system, there's surprisingly little prevention really in the system today. Risk adjusters. If we move away from the use of health status and market segmentation insurance, what do you get? You get insurers that now have to really begin to focus on quality and efficiency. And the risk adjusters goes another step and says, if you, as a health plan, wind up with a disproportionate share of high risk, you're not going to be punished. In fact, you may be rewarded. It begins to create incentives to focus on excellence. Excuse me. Steve said at the beginning, he was talking about how some employers are providing incentives for heart patients to go to the Cleveland Clinic. Well, one can imagine a whole lot more of that coming in the years to come, because insurers and systems will figure out how to develop good high quality care, and for chronic and very serious conditions, things like cancer, you encourage patients to go to places where the best outcome is, not necessarily the doctor or the hospital down the road. And if the risk adjusters go a long ways, if properly implemented, to incentivize and rewarding insurers for developing that kind of expertise and knowledge about how to deliver good quality care. And last but not least here is the Medicare experimentation. There's a huge amount of it in the Affordable Care Act. It's less specific in terms of what to do, but it gives CMS the authority to try a lot of different approaches. And we think probably through those experimentations, we're going to learn a lot about how to improve health outcomes and health delivery for the whole general population. Looking at transition ahead, I mean, the bill that this is over 2,000 pages, it's going to be imperfect. It's going to be highly imperfect. A lot of mistakes are going to be made, a lot of errors, a lot of things are going to have to be changed. That's been true with any major social legislation over the last 100 years. The question is, can we work together to make it work better, to identify the problems and fix the problems? And I'll quickly end, but just pointing out a few things, as I indicated, again, it's the essential benefits package will be a huge issue. The exchanges, I mean, will they become a true marketplace, or will they become a dumping ground for high risk? The potential for the latter is very real, and how the regulations develop and unfold in the states proceed will all be very critical. And the question about the outcome of the Medicare reforms and experiments. And last but not least, I would go back to say that right now consumer ignorance is extremely high, and we have a very steep learning curve to begin to inform the population about how to ask the right questions about health insurance. It's not just about price, but it's about quality of care. It's about value, concepts that exist among consumers generally, but issues that consumers are not used to applying to something like health insurance. And so developing information, developing tools, educating the population will continue to be a long but vital focus of efforts for reform for at least a decade or more to come. With that, I'll end it.
Great. Thank you very much, Steve. Now you get a chance to talk back, ask your questions, either on the green cards, in which case you can write them out, hold them up, and they will be brought forward, or come to the microphone. I don't think there are any microphones in the back, are there? My eyes don't reach that far. But if you want to make sure that your question gets answered, come forward. And let me just take advantage of the interregnum here and follow up on something that Steve has just said. You were talking about the need potentially to change an imperfect law. One feature of the ACA that most consumers, if you believe the polls, seem not to like very much is the individual mandate that's coming around in 2014. And I wonder, can't you just keep popular features like guaranteed issue and not using health status and get rid of this messy mandate that nobody likes?
You're asking me?
Sure.
Yes, there is. The individual mandate has become something of a rallying cry or a point for the opposition. But it's wrong and it's misguided. The fact is the pieces that we have in place in the reform, the availability, the rate reform, these things cannot work if we allow free riders, if we allow people to stay out of the system and realize the savings of not paying for health insurance until they're sick. And the fact is the consumer, the patient, has an enormous advantage. They know what their health is, and they know what their family history is, and they know to some extent when they're really at risk or who's at risk. And it's like, would you sell health insurance, homeowners insurance, to the homeowners whose house just caught on fire? No, you're not going to do it. It is a philosophical issue, and we're going to have to work through that. But from a policy standpoint, to undo the individual mandate is to probably undo the whole healthcare reform. And the fact is, I think we've made a judgment by enacting this law that there is a social value, society value, in having health and health insurance and requiring all citizens to participate and to share in that process. And I think if it were to repeal, theoretically, much the law could continue, but I suspect the effectiveness and the ultimate consequences would not be very good.
Yes, go ahead, Janet.
I just want to add something to that. You know, there is a big philosophical debate about, you know, whether the individual mandate is even constitutional, and there are a lot of differing opinions, but I would agree with Steve that in the absence of having everybody in one way or the other, you are going to have people that wait until they're sick to purchase coverage. I guess the question is whether or not that's the only way to do it, because we don't really know what the fate of the individual mandate will be. There are some other things that we could do, maybe more strict annual enrollment periods. And I mention this because we may be faced with doing it simply because the tax penalties are so low on the purchase mandate to start with, and that many people don't file income taxes. And so we're going to have to look at other ways anyway to get people in and to encourage them to be in, whether it's some late enrollment penalties or even some additional reinsurance and risk adjustment to combat this thing that could happen of people waiting until they're sick to purchase coverage. So I just wanted to add that.
Okay. Got a question here, actually a couple of questions directed to our business panelists. What regulatory changes would both small and large businesses like to see made to make implementation more to their liking? And I guess related to that, are there areas of agreement and what areas of disagreement might there be on these needed regulatory changes? Or are we in complete agreement? Steve?
Well, from the large employer perspective, we filed a number of comments that are available on our website as well as through the regulations.gov. For example, on the grandfathered plan regulation, we were kind of surprised that they have those six triggers that are very prescriptive and very restrictive, especially when you consider that this is the first time that plans have had to take off the table some changes if they want to maintain the grandfathered plan status. So we were recommending that rather than looking at each of the six triggers individually, that you should have a global aggregate trigger that's based on something like actuarial value, because there are many changes that you can make that trigger one of the six triggers that actually improve the plan for the employee. I'm thinking of the co-payment requirement. If you change from co-payment or to co-insurance for one service within the plan, does that jeopardize your grandfathered plan? According to the trigger, it probably does. So even though by making that change, you make you lower the overall employee contribution because of the overall impact on the plan. That's one of the recommendations that we had, rather than being so prescriptive and having these six triggers that may actually prohibit improvements in quality and those things that the healthcare law is trying to do by bending the cost curve. It doesn't seem to make sense to do that. For non-grandfathered plans, there already is a Department of Labor claims and appeals rule. Regulations that came out elaborating upon the requirements for non-grandfathered plans for internal appeals goes beyond that, and we're worried about the conflict between and the confusion between the Department of Labor requirements and HHS. So wherever there already is a Department of Labor process, we would recommend that that be sufficient for the plans. So those are just two little areas where, from our perspective, they're not little, they're major, that would help to simplify things and for large employer plans.
Terry?
I think the most immediate thing that small business owners are concerned about in terms of regulatory is this revenue-raising provision for expands the 1099 filing requirements. And it's unclear to small business owners what this really obligates them to, but they know it's a lot more than they're doing now. And IRS is out with a comment period on how regulations might work, and they're getting an earful. And there are some amendments here in Congress that might clean up the problem, but it's a big additional burden, and that's, I think, the biggest immediate thing that small businesses would like cleared up.
Okay.
A question for Janet and Terry, I guess, as well. If you could talk a little bit about the role of brokers selling health insurance going forward, how that might evolve, and what role they might play outside the exchanges in helping people find insurance.
Well, my organization represents brokers, so I'm really happy to respond on that one. Brokers are essential to small employers' purchase of coverage, and not just the purchase of coverage, but to helping them navigate the system after the purchase. We just recently did a survey of our members to ask them what their time was spent on. How did they service their clients? How much of it was spent on helping them find coverage, and how much was spent after they'd already placed the coverage on helping them with claims, if they were a small business, helping them with HR-related functions and so forth. And these results just came back in the last 2 weeks. 50% of their time is not spent in the sales process, but is spent after the sale. And for someone that doesn't purchase through a broker, they don't get that. And so we think the role of the broker is going to be essential, that service aspect won't matter where the purchase coverage is purchased. We anticipate and expect that they will be working with people who purchase coverage through the exchange or outside of the exchange, and that this will be a new market that they can offer to their clients, and that they will make recommendations and show the various options the same way that they do among the options that are there today, and that after the coverage is placed, they'll continue to provide service to assist them with using the coverage they've purchased regardless of where they bought it.
You know,
go ahead.
Brokers sort of from a small business point of view and medium-sized businesses that are using it, insurance brokers sort of represent the status quo. That's the way you do it now. And so that's sort of the starting point and important to think about, because if you eliminated brokers selling, for example, through the exchange, then what do you replace that with? That would be a question you have to answer. The other thing is, the insurance brokers sell more than just health insurance and provide services for those other products. So one of the implications of going down the path of, let's save money, eliminate the brokers, and the exchange could just sell direct over the internet to small businesses is
those insurance brokers are still going to be marketing their other products, and they're still going to be offering insurance in the outside market. And so, you know, they would have an incentive, per se, to sort of diminish the products in the exchange. So I think there's a lot of important things to consider from a small business point of view beyond the, oh, we could save money, initial sort of assessment of it.
I'd just like to add that, I mean, clearly Janet's description of the current system, it is what it is, but there's a, we have to recognize that, that they, the brokers and agents represent a very significant cost to the system, administrative cost. And I agree with what Janet and Terry are saying, that going forward, there's still going to be need for some kind of intermediary to help the consumers navigate the system, and the law clearly anticipates that. But what we do have to think about is how, is there a more efficient way to structure that, that assistance? And there's a new need, I mean, particularly with the Medicaid population coming into the exchange. They're going to have a lot of needs, too, in terms of navigation. And what we have to think about is how do we better educate our whole society about health care so that they can take on, be better able to navigate some of these issues that, themselves, and to the extent they can't, is there a more efficient way of organizing that assistance than we, than what the way we do it now?
Can I just follow up one step with this? We have been hearing a lot of discussion of the medical loss ratio, and I wonder if you could talk a little about the impact of including brokers' fees that insurance companies might pay in the denominator in calculating that ratio, and thus presumably lowering the number, making it tougher to get to the statutory requirement, and how you adapt to that from the broker standpoint?
Well, the biggest difference probably is in the individual market, to be honest with you, as opposed to, there's much more commission variation in that market than there is in the small employer market, considerably more. And so I think there will be some impact on the level of broker commission there. We actually have advocated for something called a pass-through. And the reason we've done that, and what that basically means is that you may wonder how someone gets an agent or broker. And basically, they aren't assigned to a consumer by the insurance company. The consumer picks who they want. And if that person is licensed and represents companies, then the commission flows back through that way. But it's really done as a convenience to the consumer, so they write one check, which includes the broker fee along with that. And the pass-through would just eliminate it out of the calculation altogether. And I don't know if that will happen, but I do know that many people value the role that their brokers play. Regardless of changes that we may see in the future, we have other things that we've looked at. The purchasing pools, which were kind of the precursor of the exchanges, many of them tried all over the country. Many of them tried to start off not using brokers and didn't attract enough enrollees until they started using them. And so I think there is a value, an ongoing value for the use of that and for providing the service that's needed. And the medical loss ratio, you know, Ed, it's still up for grabs. It's still being discussed. But we do anticipate some changes, particularly in the individual market. The best thing that could happen right now would be a phase-in or a delay of when it occurs. In some geographic areas, if the medical loss ratio is implemented the way it is now, we may have some carriers that just leave the market, and that isn't good for consumers because they have fewer choices. This is before 2014. They would exit early, and so that's not a good outcome either.
Steve, you have a quick comment?
Yes. I'm also a consumer representative to the NAIC, and we as a group, the consumer reps, have strongly opposed this pass-through. The purpose of the medical loss ratio is to provide a measure of how much benefits over the premium dollar goes out. And the reality is that the brokers, and I completely acknowledge that they play an important role, but it is an important part of the cost. And it is one of the, you know, the fact is in the individual market, commissions can be as much as 20% or more. And if you want to pay that, as a consumer, okay, that's your prerogative. But by but it is a part of the expense. There's no question about that. And the law is fairly clear about that. So the question is, does it, is it somehow unfair to include this expense? No. I mean, that's part of what we want to do through the reform is to make the consumers more aware of what they're actually getting for their dollar. And if you want to spend your dollars in a system that provides more broker assistance, okay, but no, that's what it is. You have to call it for what it is. So I think the notion of taking it out of this equation is absolutely wrong from a consumer perspective, and it would be probably a violation of the law to do that.
Well, we may not be able to settle this on our panel, but we will keep an eye on it as we go ahead. Yes, we have somebody at the microphone. You want to identify yourself and keep your question as brief as possible.
Hi, Ed. Ed Neuschler with the Institute for Health Policy Solutions. Kind of half a comment and half a question. Terry Gardner, in his presentation, appropriately emphasized that one of the benefits of exchanges for small employers is going to be worker choice of the plan, so that the employer, you don't get in the situation where an employer with 5 or 6 or 8 employees picks one plan, and that's all their workers get to choose from. It's pretty clear in the statute that that's what's intended. That is one of the big selling points of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association exchange that Terry mentioned a few times. That's really one of their selling points in the market. And I think it would be a shame if that kind of thing got lost. But I've heard that there's kind of a rear guard action being fought by some of the insurers, and I'm not sure who else. Maybe in the context of any NAIC meetings, I'm not entirely sure about that either, arguing that trying to do worker choice in the small employer exchange will be, quote, too hard, and that it shouldn't be required. I just think that would be a horrible loss, and if any of the panelists would like to comment on that, I'd like to hear what they have to say.
Okay. I think what we've learned is there are real administrative management issues to implementing that, but as Connecticut has proven, it can be done, and it can be done efficiently. And so, you know, I think it's one of those issues where you got to take it as a realistic problem. It has complexities, and we don't want the burden foisted off on the small businesses. Here, you go figure out how to allocate all these dollars. But in the day and age of IT, that's what the answer has been in Connecticut. They have been able to put together a system that is simple from the insurer's point of view on this side and simple from the employer's side, and they perform that function very efficiently and effectively.
Right, Janet.
I'm not talking against the concept of worker choice, but I want to explain what you have to be careful of, because I think this is a big issue. In the purchasing pools that have been tried in the past, most of them, virtually all of them, were small employer market. And when you have employee choice, an interesting thing happens. When people can choose among the policies whichever one they want, they do exactly that, and they choose what's best for them, which sometimes means that the carriers and the policies that offer the widest array of choice within that policy type, usually PPOs, tend to be selected more often by people who are really sick because they want that flexibility to go outside of networks and so forth if they want. And this was a huge problem with risk adjustment for every one of those purchasing pools. And what happened in virtually every case is that the PPOs would start pulling out and saying, you know, we don't want to be here anymore. And you'd be left with a small number of carriers. And eventually, most of them kind of self-imploded because there wasn't really enough choice there to keep it going. And so my only comment is, because we know that can happen, we tried to put some provisions in the law that would pool coverage inside and outside the exchange together to prevent that very thing from happening so that the exchange wouldn't self-implode. But I'm not entirely convinced that we've done everything we need to do with risk adjustment. And so we need to be really careful with that, to keep looking and making sure that risk adjustment is right, so that consumers have a lot of choices inside the exchange and outside the exchange, and that the coverages continues to be pooled together so that the exchange doesn't become that a de facto high-risk pool or a place only for low-income people. You want it to be another good and vibrant market for people.
Can I just ask the other panelists to jump in on this, too? But I've been hearing for 20 years that we're right around the corner from having a perfect risk adjuster that's going to make us compete on value and not on selection. Are we around the corner now? Is this going to work? How much diligence, as Janet implies, do we have to employ here to make sure that it doesn't implode?
If we're right around the corner, I haven't found the corner yet. I mean, seriously, I don't know a whole lot about it. I've been asking a fair number of, I think, knowledgeable people, and they say the potential is there, but a hell of a lot of work needs to be done. It's just one more of those pieces that it's the right piece to have there, and it is essential to making this work. But is it a guarantee or a shoo-in? I'm certainly not under the impression that's true.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, I might just add one thing. Utah has gone forward already and set up their exchange, and one of the interesting things they've done, and I haven't seen a lot of written or analysis, is they have a prospective risk adjustment system that was actually designed by the insurers working in the pool in conjunction with the exchange management. And so that may supply, a new approach to look at. So there.
Very good.
But it's not based on value, which was the question. You know, the question was this is risk adjustment. So there has to be some way to assess the losses. This is insurance. So you have to be able to either look on the front end and say, where are we likely to get the losses, or in the end say, where did they occur most? Let's adjust back to the people who didn't get as many poor risks. So you've got to have either on the front or on the end or some combination of the two, so that you don't have carriers saying that, you know, we can't do this, we're losing our shirts in this arrangement and we have to get out. So there's got to be some way to do that. It's really, really important, and I don't think we have it figured out yet.
Yes, go ahead.
Sarah Cliff with Politico. I was wondering if you all could talk a little bit, it's a bit of a follow-up, on what the key things you want to see states doing this year, next year, as they set up their exchanges, kind of from the folks you represent. What are the things you're watching from states as they make decisions about how to create an exchange?
Steve, you're in the inside in that NAIC discussion.
It's a very good question. I think from our perspective, my organization's perspective, and some of the other consumers, I think there are a series of critical questions that states should be required to address in the first year of a planning grant. One of the big problems, and we've mentioned it here briefly this morning, is the potential for adverse selection. And so how are the states going to construct the exchanges to deal with that issue? Are they going to have an outside the market? And if so, by what rules is it going to operate? Are they going to merge the individual and small group market? And if so, how? I mean, think of small states, the Wyomings, the Dakotas, the Rhode Islands, or the Vermonts, where they have very small populations total. By aggregating the individual and small group markets, they have more potential. But there are administrative concerns, and they're the kinds of things that Terry was alluding to, and Janet as well, in terms of the particular needs of small businesses. Unfortunately, the HHS, in issuing the grants, did not put down those kinds of markers, but there's still the opportunity to address that. But if the states don't grapple with sort of those fundamental structural issues in the first year, their ability to actually get an exchange that's well-functioning up in place, and by 2014, I think becomes problematic.
Well, and I would agree with a lot of what Steve has said. I think we certainly want to make sure that there is a market both inside and outside the exchange, and to ensure that consumers have plenty of choices and for a number of other reasons as well. But also we want to make sure that there are options. When we start looking at these models, you know, the same model is not going to work in every state. Every state doesn't want or need Massachusetts, and every state doesn't want or need Utah, which are the two main models that we have right now. So we've got to have some different choices that states can select from based on their particular demographics. We'd like to see a little bit less regulatory approach, and not so that we're not creating cost and duplicating services that already exist at the state level. And I think states would be the first ones to say that they don't have any extra money to throw into this themselves, and they have no expectation that the federal government's going to be funding the whole operation for an extended period of time. So they know that they're going to have to be self-sustaining. There's a lot of questions about what do you do with your exchange in terms of what role does the exchange have in screening people who might be eligible for public programs like Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program and other programs that exist. Will it be a facilitator to go back to the agencies that handle those? Or some states are actually talking about bringing everything together under one roof, and or in some way doing that, which is quite a big undertaking, but a number of them are looking at it. So we are, just want to make sure that the cost to everyone in the market doesn't go up because of the existence of an exchange. And that has happened in Massachusetts, and so we would like a little bit less regulatory approach than what we've done there, and take advantage of the insurance departments that already exist, but still giving the exchange enough authority to do the calculations and make sure that people get to the other public programs in addition to the coverage that's actually offered, the private coverage through the exchange, as well as the other options that are there.
Okay. Can I just mention two other things, Ed, that came to mind? Is one is the whole issue of systems, a huge issue that not very sexy and so it doesn't get discussed a whole lot, but it's absolutely critical, is what are the informational IT structures in place to do it? It's questions about the whole enrollment process, how do you merge the Medicaid into the general insurance population, but even the bigger thing is the whole issue of subsidies. I mean, that is just huge. The subsidy structure is extraordinarily complex. It's rigid at the high end. And then you've got this whole issue of cost sharing for the Medicaid, part of the Medicaid population, or certain subsegment of the population under 400%. And the IRS has very strict rules about privacy and security of tax information, as it well should, but who has access to it, how. They have very high standards for sharing that information. Building that infrastructure, the information IT structure, is going to be an enormous task and probably the most difficult to go forward. And I don't think HHS has made clear yet whether it's going to provide prototype technology for the states or how, to what extent they're going to try to regulate there and standardize that among the states. But it'll be a huge issue. And if the states haven't made significant progress by within a year in dealing with that issue, again, the possibilities of state exchanges becomes problematic in 2014.
Steve?
Even though large employers don't have the option to participate in the exchanges until 2017, if states allow, and it's not clear that they will, we do have an interest in seeing that the exchanges work. And one of the things that I think is important, especially after hearing some of the discussion about the risk adjustment, is that each exchange have some kind of independent actuarial certification of the actuarial soundness of any of the plan requirements or rating that they do, so that the exchanges are viable, and that has to be a very important consideration. And I don't know if it's the American Academy of Actuaries or the Society of Actuaries, but some independent actuarial body certifies that everything is actuarially sound. I think that's going to be critical.
You want to say a few more words about that? At what level does the exchange's soundness come into play? I mean, are you worried about the subsidy payments not going out or the insurance companies not getting paid?
Well, I don't think anybody has, everybody has a stake in making sure that these exchanges work, that it works for everybody, including the insurers, but also the participants. And so I think just having an independent actuarial certification will help out and provide that reassurance on both sides that there's going to be some kind of actuarial soundness to whatever the exchanges create.
Okay.
I think what we'd like to see is that every legislature act in 2011 and set up the framework for their exchange. If they don't, they're not going to have an exchange up and running in 2013, ready to provide insurance in January 1st, 2014. Second, in the governance structure or through some system to make sure that small employers actually have some voice in how this exchange will be set up and work for small business owners. We think it's important for them to consider what is the size of this exchange is going to be, and because the administrative costs are going to get passed on. So somebody needs to actually budget this out and figure out what's going to work. In the case of Massachusetts, they have now 3%, which is getting passed on, but we don't. It's not going to work if it's a much higher cost. The other thing is that many people have pointed out there's an opportunity if the exchange is organized correctly with the appropriate size and to promote consumers adopting high-value plan that it can be a force helping drive delivery system reform. So I think that opportunity needs to be taken advantage of because that goes to the very issue of cost and affordability. And again, as I said, we've got to have an exchange that is a single point of entry for small employers if we expect them to access and use it.
Let me just remind you that as we wind down the last 10 or 15 minutes of questions, we'd appreciate your filling out that evaluation form for us. Terry, you just brought up again the question of delivery system change, and a questioner would like you to expand on how this is in fact a key issue for employers, that that delivery system reform is connected to what small businesses are expecting and hoping to get out of these reforms.
Well, one part of the Health Reform Act appropriated some money for prevention and wellness programs for small business. And when you look at the Kaiser report, it documents very well that large employers have done a lot better and a lot more, about three times as much in terms of percentage of companies in terms of prevention and wellness programs. So we need to work towards small employers doing the same. So those 42 million people that work at small employers and the 22 million self-employed are participating in similar programs that have proven successful at larger employers. One of the ways that we've looked at that the exchange can work is the employer is, as they access the exchange, they would benchmark a plan that, you know, works for their budget. And then employees get to choose their plan. But if it's a higher cost plan, then, of course, they could buy up and pay that. So there needs to be thought through by the exchange as they set these up how to promote high value plans, not just simply cost, but we've got to look at the health outcomes, that balance of cost, which sometimes summed up to saying high value plans. So we want to see that promoted, and there are some plans that around the country that have worked towards this. So we have some models to work out there, and we think in those ways the exchange can play a role in the long term in driving better costs.
I've got a very practical question dealing with exchanges. Where can states, presumably having some discretion in designing these things, get information on the types of exchanges that are out there, and how can they successfully implement these exchanges? Now, where is the information, other than getting John Kingsdale to come to your office?
Can I make a
sure.
comment? Well, actually, there, as I said before, we had many purchasing pools before, but we have two state exchanges up and running now, Utah and Massachusetts. Actually, we have a chart comparing the two with the main features of the two of them that is really easy, and we're happy to provide that if people would be interested in looking at what the main issues are, how they differ from each other, because they're the two main models we have today. But I will say that, as far as I know, the NAIC is still on track for putting out model legislation of what they call a skeletal model of what the choices are and what the main choice areas that states would have by their October meeting, which is, I think it's October 21st that they'll be voting on that or somewhere around there. And so they'll have information very soon, and I know a number of the state insurance departments are getting lots of questions and information from the NAIC on that.
And if you would like to provide us with an electronic version of that comparison, we'll make sure that we put it on our website and you can get it with the rest of the materials.
I'll do that.
Oh, Terry?
Yeah, I mentioned one other source that's out there that's ongoing too is that, and Tim Jost was a member of one of the panels here previously, and he's doing, along with some other authors, a series of papers, and one has already been published, and I think another one's coming out very soon through Commonwealth, available on the Commonwealth side, and he's covering a lot of the questions that all of us are throwing out there and being debated.
Yes, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you very much for putting this on. It's been very helpful. My name is Andrew Davis. I'm with Medco Health Solutions. We're a proud member of Steve's organization. I'm going to take this in a little bit different direction. Terry, you mentioned the RAND report. There's also a counter argument that the CBO estimates around employer commitment to providing health insurance through 2019 is overly optimistic and very rosy. I guess from the small business perspective and the large employer perspective, what are going to be the tipping points or those moments that are going to cause an employer to rethink and actually take action towards no longer providing either pre-65 or post-65 insurance coverage and to really move that liability and risk into an exchange in 2014, or maybe even move towards a defined contribution approach for a pre-65 and really offload and cap that risk? Are there things that your members are telling you that, look, if we had a pain threshold of cost or regulation or something, then we're going to make the big move? I just would welcome your perspectives on what you think could happen there.
Good question.
We're hearing a lot from our members and their clients on this very issue, so I'm glad you asked that question. So here's the typical conversation that we have with them. First of all, it depends, and right now I'm going to focus on a little bit larger employers, the ones that are subject to the employer mandate, which isn't that large of an employer, by the way. So it could be many employers will be subject to it. And so their question is, it has to do with the fine. So there's a $2,000 fine if any of your employees access coverage to the exchange and you didn't offer coverage. Now, many of the employers who are don't have a big tax liability are looking at this and saying, that is much less than what I'm paying today, and that's the first stopping point. It has to, and now this fine is not deductible for them. So those that are doing well, that's not where their trigger point is, because they don't want to have a $2,000 fine for a lot of employees that they can't deduct. That's not a good business decision for them. For the group, what I see most often is where they stop is when you get to the affordability issue. So they're already doing what they think is the right thing, and they still have this ability for employees to opt out and go to the exchange even when they already provided them coverage, even when it met the minimum standards, because the employee's family income was below a certain level. And, of course, they have no way to know the family income in order to more appropriately peg the employer contribution and make it affordable for them. And that's the number one place where I see that decision, where they throw up their hands and they say, you know, when the time comes, I just think I'm not going to do it because if I can't, you know, I can't win for losing. I've heard this more than one time, such that I'm very concerned about that happening too many times. And so I would be hopeful. We were talking about the regulatory things that could be done. I would be hopeful that we can look at that and maybe look at those affordability provisions to make them a little bit more business friendly so that these employers stay in the game and keep offering coverage and don't decide to dip out. And then on the small employer side, it's really an affordability issue, and those that have been paying, some of them that have been doing it, well, they all do it to attract the best employees, but some of them that are thinking about opting out are looking at how much their employees make and how many of those employees might be eligible for subsidies, and they're saying, well, maybe my employees will be just fine because now they'll have this subsidy in the exchange, they'll still be okay even if I don't provide this anymore. And so I think that's something else that we're going to have to address. Yeah, we're giving them this tax credit, but I think we've got to keep both the small employers and the large employers providing coverage the way they do today, and even get more of them to do so. But those are the trigger points that I see, and you can almost watch the looks on their faces when they start talking about it, and I don't think it's anything we actually anticipated at that level or that we would want.
Steve?
I can add on. I think the material that was provided, that was the Towers-Watson survey, said that 88% of employers, when the penalties come in, are likely to continue offering coverage. And as Janet said, there are lots of reasons for, especially the larger employers, to continue because they realize that it's a major retention and attraction of talent issue, which, you know, we are facing on the beginning of a labor shortage, despite the high unemployment rate. You know, the next wave of people entering the workforce is a lot smaller than the wave that's retiring, and that's part of the whole underlying issue that employers, especially the large ones, recognize that there's going to be a race for talent, so they're going to want to provide attractive benefits, including health benefits. There are health and productivity reasons I mentioned before. You know, they're very interested in making sure their employees are healthy and more productive, reducing absenteeism, sick days. And they know it's all connected to workers' comp and disability. You mentioned other products that I was thinking, gosh, a large employer is kind of like an internal broker because they have to deal with all these other benefits, life, accident, disability, workers' comp, and it's all related. So if you get rid of the health benefit, you lose your control over your disability costs, your workers' comp costs, and all those other things. So they take that into account. For health and safety reasons, many employers have to provide some kind of health benefits and coverage because of the nature of the work or the location of the work. And then there are some employers that feel that they can do a better job and they have better risk, so they're going to want to continue because they think they can provide better coverage at a better cost than any alternative. Other things that would trigger or worry employers if, you know, we have to start reporting the health cost of health benefits on the W-2 forms, if we go to full taxation beyond the Cadillac tax, I think that will be a big decision for lots of employers about is it still worth it to provide coverage when there are no more tax advantages for the employer or the employee. So that's a big issue, and I know that relates to the larger tax policy issues too. And then the cash-out voucher, if that is expanded at all, that poses a big issue for employers in terms of adverse selection because the younger and healthier employees are likely to say, hey, I can get a better deal on the exchange or somewhere else, and the employer plan for the next year is going to be stuck with the higher risks and higher costs and trying to figure out how to pass that on and where to make that up in terms of the employer side. And then more people are going to drop out because they're going to say, hey, my employer coverage is more expensive. I can get a better deal elsewhere in this newly created market with new options. So next year it's going to be even higher, and ultimately the employer is going to give up at some point. So that's a big issue for the cash out capability is a big issue for employers if that's expanded at all.
When
We hear many different things from different types of small employer groups because their businesses are structured so different, and they are having quite different reactions and assessments of it. So I'll give a few examples, like franchise owners. Their current models, they have large numbers relatively of low-wage employees, and they have a lot of turnover, and they basically provide health benefits to their management-level people. Well, they're going to be subject to the free rider. So their choices are, I'd say, very problematical, trying to figure out which way works best for them. So they've got some tough choices, and we've gone through the numbers with them. Other firms are trying to figure out whether they meet the basic minimums. They're unclear, like, whether they already, you know, are basically providing, you know, if they're over 50, they're concerned, is their benefit going to meet the minimum standards? And so they're looking for an answer to that. That's their biggest problem. The 22 million self-employed, they're basically seeing this as upside to them and more opportunity. They don't generally have employees, or if they do, they're part-time, or they have contracts, or they have partners, and they have been for years scratching their head, and in many cases avoided employees for this very reason. So they're seeing advantages. But I think ultimately most of the people that are currently providing and thinking they could provide, if this is provides more opportunities, they're looking at the affordability. What is the cost? So it really goes down to how effectively this does it really provide a more affordable product and a more stable cost product than they're used to, in which case that's good news. If it's not going to accomplish those goals, then it could be a step backwards.
Okay, I think we've just about come to the end of our time. We have not exhausted this subject. There are incredible numbers of aspects of this topic that we weren't able to sort completely out. But as we alluded to, this isn't the last implementation briefing we're going to be having. So keep tuned, and we'll try to explain some more, or have others who know this stuff very well explain more to all of us. Let me just take a moment to thank once again the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for thinking through this briefing with us and helping us put it together, and Brian Quinn especially with his colleagues to contribute to the way the briefing went forward. Thank you for staying with it on a beautiful late summer day. I just want to take a second before I thank the panel to note that Lisa Swirsky, who's a member of a policy staff of the Alliance, who did the heavy lifting on putting this briefing together, is leaving us after about 6 years at the Alliance. And I want to take this opportunity to thank her and to wish her her best in her new duties, not unconnected to healthcare and consumers at Consumers Union. Lisa, thanks very much. And as I mentioned, I would ask you to join me in thanking our panelists for an incredibly good discussion of a very difficult topic. And we'll see you next time. Don't forget those evaluation forms. He said, flogging the horse once again.